Welcome to the BFM Historical Society. This week, we talk to Troy Ferguson, a man who's been around BFM for a number of years and seen it from all sorts of angles, inside and out. Welcome to the BFM Historical Society, Troy Ferguson.
Hello. I do want to say, first up, I'm doing this under duress.
Well, there were extenuating circumstances, one of which was Andrew Black texting me saying, I'm in Queenstown Hospital right now with a collapsed lung and broken ribs.
So you get Troy Ferguson instead. The reason I'm doing this under duress is that, number one, I don't think that I can provide any real insight into any of BFM's history, and nor do I think that in the time that I've been here that I've made enough of an impact in any way to actually warrant one of these.
Your first introduction to BFM and how and when you came to be involved?
Well, in the late 1970s in Auckland, it was a cultural wasteland. It was hideous. I think it's been said before on this, but the only place you could hear punk rock in New Zealand was on 1ZM at nights on Barry Jenkins' show. Radio with Pictures was on, but what we forget with our rose-tinted spectacles is that on Radio with Pictures there was a whole heap of crap week after week, and you just have to wait for something really good to come along. Around Easter 1979, a friend of mine at school, Kathy, said to me, what radio station do you listen to? And obviously it was 1ZM because Barry Jenkins was on. I said, oh, 1ZM. And she goes, ah, you're a bloody idiot. You should listen to Radio Bosom. And I said, why is that? She goes, because they play Dave Bowie and The Clash and Frank Zappa. And I was sold, even though when I did tune in and listen, I didn't hear Dave Bowie or Frank Zappa or The Clash on it. But nonetheless, I'd become aware of its existence then. And it did become more important over the next couple of years. And people who grew up at that time will remember that there was a much greater participation in the kind of subsets of popular culture. People who liked things committed to it completely. You had the punks, you had the heavy metal guys, you had the mods, you had all of these different subsets, and everyone was completely committed to what they were into and totally into it. And I think part of the reason for this was because of the tyranny of distance. We were a long way from everywhere else, and we were actually quite removed from everywhere else in that you'd have to wait for records to be released for an awful long time. You know, we had Rip It Up and In Touch magazines. They were great, but it wasn't quite enough. And you'd have to wait for 3 months for the NME. And one of the important things about getting the NME wasn't just for the three-month-old news, but it was for the ads in the back. Because the only way you could get stuff really was by mail ordering it. Now, you've probably seen photographs of the 1960s in New Zealand where people were dressed really sharp and there was like a bunch of, you know, New Zealand-style mods and everyone looked great. By the 1970s, it was people in shorts. It was just horrifying, and there was no good clothes you could buy. I think there was a lot of import restrictions, so they would make Levi's in this country, and they wouldn't make them to what you wanted, like 501s or anything, but these shapeless sacks. It was just horrible.
Or bell-bottoms.
Bell-bottoms.
It was all bell-bottoms and long hair and bad moustaches.
It was horrible.
It was all walk shorts, ties, walk socks.
And you'd mail order your clothes. You'd mail order 7-inch singles. It would take 3 or 4 months for the stuff to get here, but it was an important thing. You sort of had to do that. That was part of the rules of participating in popular culture.
People fully committing and splitting off to be something, a lot of it was a reaction to ordinary blokeness. And if a lot of kids growing up just didn't want to be into drinking beer or playing rugby. But if you weren't going to be that ordinary Kiwi bloke, then you had to be something else. And so you had to kind of really be something else, going to be a new romantic, or you were going to be a punk, but you had to be something.
It wasn't so much just doing something in opposition. I think it was being part of something, because at that time also in New Zealand, if you weren't that normal mainstream thing, you were just excluded. And I spent a lot of my life being completely excluded. I went to a high school where they'd have bands come and play at lunchtime. You know, it would cost 20 cents. Toy Love came along and played. You know, the following year, Blam 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 played. I think we had the spelling mistakes. I miss seeing the Scavengers.
I had no idea any of those bands played at Borstal.
Finally felt like there was something happening. Bringing this back to BFM, it was like a case of, where do we hear this stuff? And sure enough, in the holidays, be able to hear Bosom. I remember Peter McLennan recording all the shows that he could so we'd have something to listen to when it went off air. Now, around about 1981, while New Zealand was still in the 1950s, we were stuck in the 50s while there was all this great stuff going on everywhere else.
Muldoon was the Prime Minister, and the Springbok tour was happening. And it
was oppressive. It seemed like we were being oppressed by the stylists or something. At that time, a group called Dance Macabre appeared. Dance Macabre included Nigel Russell, who had been in the Spelling Mistakes, though he'd moved from bass to lead vocals and synth in this group. I still think now that they are the most overlooked and underrated band in New Zealand history. At the time, it felt like they were the only group in New Zealand who had embraced the future and were up there with all of those other things that we were hearing from elsewhere, like, dare I say it, Visage. And Depeche Mode and all and these other sort of groups. Anyway, this here is from their first EP, Between the Lines, which came out in late 1981. There was a video on Radio Pictures for the song Between the Lines, but we won't play that. We'll play one called Conditioner.
Trust is born.
Simon Coffey, a guy who was in our group of friends, started Auckland University. He started a club. I can't remember what the club was all about, but he put on gigs at the university caf, and he decided that he'd start doing graveyards. And his reasoning for that is that he lived on the North Shore, and he figured if he was coming over to a show in town, he could come up here and go all through the night and catch the bus home in the morning. He would crash his Mini frequently. I'm not suggesting that he ever drove drunk, but I think he may have drove tired. Somewhere on the North Shore, he crashed in through the front door of someone's house in his Mini, then reversed away and took off up the road.
Can you do a hit and run on a house?
Well, I think he did. Simon was also the kind of person that didn't like doing things by himself or would get bored doing it and would wander off halfway through. So we would come up and do the shows with him. And we did come up and meet, I think it was Jonathan might have been the station manager at the time. Our whole group of people wasn't a particularly sensible crowd of people, so I'm really surprised that they put us in charge of a radio show. I know there's a really good live scene, which is pretty much continued since the 80s in this city, but it was particularly exciting back then because it was so dangerous. You know, you'd go out to see these shows. The first thing you'd do is you'd find the escape route in case a certain group of people came along to smash everyone over, or in case the police came to get you out of the pub for being under 20. There was a lot of shows also in church halls. There'd usually only be one show there, and then there would never be allowed to be another one. In addition to going to shows at the time, the only other thing that you could do if you weren't that mainstream New Zealander we were talking about earlier on was go to clubs. Now, one of the subsets of popular culture that I mentioned earlier, and a really important one in the early 1980s, was the hairdressers. Now, the hairdressers, they could be guys or girls, but either way, they were always like totally on the cutting edge of what was happening. And there was a club called Keys that we went to until we got banned for some reason. I don't remember why. In about 1985, I think the Brat opened. Was that Ehrlich and Mark Phillips opened the Brat?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Brat was great. We went there all the time, every Thursday, every Friday, every Saturday. And the thing that was great about the Brat is that it wasn't like something as simple as an indie club or anything like that. It would play a wide variety of stuff. You know, we liked New Order, of course, you know, and that was kind of dance music. And even though it sounds like it might be embarrassing to like the Fatback Band or things like that, you know, we were all into that. That was fun. And another group that we really liked was the Style Council. And when this song would come on, it was just great. It's a classic Philly soul sound from a guy that used to be in the Jam, who was important. The Jam were really important in this country to a lot of people. And here he was making this fantastic Philly soul sounding music. This is a tune called Shout to the Top.
Down on We're gonna shout to the top, shout. We're gonna shout to the top, shout. We're gonna shout to the top, shout. We're gonna shout to the top, shout.
So hearing that song does remind me of Peter Ehrlich and Mark Phillips, and it also reminds me of Hairdressers, who were basically on to the best new music at that time of a type, and were the ones who kept the clubs going.
BFM was playing a lot of dance music of the time. You know, when you listen to some of the historical societies and you think, wow, they only played like Husker Du and the Pixies and Headless Chickens. That wasn't the case at all. It was quite broad. And it wasn't
Haircut
just...
Haircut 100, yep. Heaven 17, all that sort of stuff. Depeche Mode.
I mean, everyone, of course, has a selective memory, including myself. But B was always much, much wider than this sort of distance will let us remember. I went away and lived in Europe and everything for a long time. And when I came back in the early 90s, BFM had transformed somewhat. It had started to enter what is now considered to be the golden age. As people always say, you know you're living in a golden age when it seems like it's never going to end. That's kind of what it felt like coming back in the early 90s. Suddenly, it wasn't just a select group of people who knew about BFM. Suddenly, it had busted through into mainstream consciousness. Suddenly, the people on it were stars. Suddenly, you know, everything had changed in the time I'd been away. And I was so excited, you know. It wasn't that, oh, I have to get on the radio because I want to be famous. It was just another one of those things where you think, I've got to be able to participate and contribute somehow. So I figured there's no way I'd be able to actually get a show in this more professional environment because I'm not really very good at anything. Around that time, you know, BFM would do a lot of events. There was all those private functions. There was summer series. It was all these different things going on all of the time that you could participate and contribute in, whether you wanted to go on air or not, which I kind of didn't for a little while. But Simon Coffey again, he did Drives and he did the Hard, Fast and Heavy show. Most people who know Simon Coffey will know that his attention span that won't last through a two-hour show, and he would quite often become distracted and wander off and do his own thing. So it was always good for Simon to have someone there that could actually operate the show while he'd gone off to do whatever he did in the time that he wandered off. So I figured, okay, well, I'll help out where I can, but I don't really have much of a chance of getting a show, so I'll just back up Simon and do whatever on his shows.
Say, would it be fair to say that your tastes were more towards the American underground and hardcore sort of stuff, and Simon's taste was more sort of heavy metal and that end of things?
I would say so, because I've never really been a big fan of heavy metal music. When it comes down to it, I like punk rock, but heavy metal just to me seemed a bit too hysterical.
I think you made quite a good balance for the sort of stuff Simon was into, because it was different. It was still hard, fast and heavy, but it was different. Was it him that gave you the T-Roy moniker?
No, I think that was you, actually. It was, because I remember one day we were talking about U-Roy and I-Roy and, you know, these reggae greats. And I think you said, you know, if you were a reggae toaster, you could be T-Roy. And I think that's where that came from.
Wow.
And that was years before we formed the reggae DJs against people who are against things. Which we possibly will go into or possibly not.
I was going to say society hasn't been very active lately, but there still seem to be a lot of people out there who are against things.
That's right.
More than ever.
I think we should revive the society sooner rather than later. Anyhow, a lot of people think BFM only started playing dance music and electronic music in the late 90s, which may actually be the first time most people have heard those things. But of course, BFM have been playing things as far back as the normal. A huge BFM hit in the early 90s was an album by Primal Scream called Screamadelica. One of the best singles from that album was a version of Higher Than the Sun from that record, remixed by The Orb. It's called Higher Than the Orb. In the late 90s, in fact, I think it was 97, you started working here, and 98, I started working here. It was a peculiar time because BFM was really riding high. Everything was great, and everyone really wanted to be part of it and everything. What you couldn't see from the outside was the exclusion which went on inside. there was a particular clique of people that kind of ran things up here. And it's been mentioned before about the bullying and whatever. To me, it seemed like a bunch of upper middle class people who wanted to exclude those from outside of their class, like me and like you, Dubhead. And they made fun of us mercilessly, and we weren't allowed to be in their cool club. Do you remember all of that?
That's right. It was kind of like the British imperialists playing cricket, and they weren't going to let the girls or the brown people play cricket with them.
It kind of felt like that. So, but nonetheless, we both worked here in the late 90s. I was on reception, I think, for about a year and a half in total. And I generally found that most of the listeners were super friendly, nice people, and they were so passionate about music, and they were really passionate about BFM. It was really great. Usually, the time which was different, of course, was when the guy came in with the machete, and you wouldn't help me. In that time, you know, there was lots of comings and goings of staff members, and there's a lot of people that will be forgotten because they weren't big stars on air or anything like that, but there were so many great people. Most of the people who have worked here have been here for the right reasons, and they've been nothing but a pleasure to deal with. There's the exceptions, but you probably get that at Pack and Save or wherever as well. And around that time, Gemma Gracewood approached me one day. Gemma was particularly important to BFM as the news and editorial director who really, really made the biggest mark on the station and turning it from a copy of the news out of the Herald and do half-assed interviews into something which was really worthwhile. Anyway, Gemma came to me one day and said, I think you should do the Rock and Roll Wire. Now, a number of other people had done the Rock and Roll Wire in the past. Rob Young was before me. Before that was Justin.
Reading.
Justin Redding. And I figured that'd be great. They'll let me on, and I'll probably be on for about 3 months. And Bill Curtin said, you know, you mumble too much, Troy, and you do this and you do that, but we'll let you have a go for a while. I still do that show. Well, hopefully by the time you hear this, I'll still be doing it. So I've been doing that show for 11 years, which is a bit longer than the 3 months that I figured that I'd get to do it. But in the time, you know, I got to speak to a lot of really great people, and I really enjoyed doing interviews because I kind of want to know what people think and what they like and what they're into.
One of the things I like about the Rock and Roll Wire heaps is that you would have sometimes regular, sometimes sporadic contributors from all sorts of other places on the planet, and I really like that. Like, you know, the Melvins would ring up and they were on tour, or Jack White would ring up from somewhere to say how things were going, or give his upholstery report or whatever it was he would do as a and people Owen the Jackal, and
people seem to think I squander interviews talking about, you know, the wrong kind of stuff. The other thing, of course, is when we both started working here together, by about 2000 or 2001, we were both working in the programming department, spending all of our time listening to stuff and go, this is cool, this is cool, this is great, this is fun. Wow, if people get to hear this, they're really going to dig it. And one of those discoveries we made was the Mint Chicks. We got their first ever demo, and I remember that the day we were listening to it going, wow, these dudes must really like the Gang of Four and Wire and all of this stuff. And of course, later when we actually met them for the first time, when they came up to do a live tour and forgot to bring the guitars, they hadn't heard any of that music. They just completely invented all of this stuff.
It was hilarious. They said they wanted to try and be like punk rock, like the Buzzcocks, but they hadn't heard of any of the post-punk sort of Public Image Limited and Gang of Four stuff that we thought that they were really influenced by. Now, we've also got to give quick credit here at this point to Stinky Jim, who actually was dealing with one of the Mint Chicks guys because he was putting together the Sideways compilation.
That's right, Michael Logie.
Yes, and Michael had a bunch of electronic music that he was submitting to Jim for Jim's compilation, and then he also sort of said, oh, look, you're involved in BFM. Here's this other band I'm in. Maybe you can give it to someone up there. And Jim passed it on to us and said, look, I'm really not into this sort of stuff, but you guys might like it. And that was it.
The Mint Chicks, they got signed by Flying Nun. And then when it came time for them to deliver their second EP, they proudly took their second EP along to Flying Nun, who hate the story being told. For whatever reason, Flying Nun said, that's not very good, we're not going to release it. And so Ruben said, oh, I really want people to hear it. I know. We'll see if Troy will play it on the Rock and Roll Wire, and people can tape it if they want. Eventually, Flying Nun did release the Anti-Tiger EP, but for the first place you could hear it was on BFM. This is a song from that, from the Mint Chicks, Blue Team Go. Well, like I said with the Dance Macabre track at the beginning, you know, hearing something like the Minchicks shining out of all of this late period trip hop that was coming in, it was really, really exciting and really fun. But
you can talk about trumpet dub if you like.
I think both Dubhead and I have to take responsibility for a number of things which happened in programming over that time. We championed trumpet dub from Wellington. We pushed it really hard. We pushed Fat Freddy's Drop. If you don't like Fat Freddy's Drop and you want someone to blame, well, okay, I'll put my hand up. And we're partly to blame for
that. And the Black Seeds and Salmonella dub.
We did all of that stuff. But it was something that was happening. We wanted to be reflective of what was happening.
And I think we also have to take responsibility for something else, which was the browning of the playlist. Because we were putting Ill Semantics and Decepticons and Red Eye Society and P Money and all these things on the playlist.
That was a really exciting period, like feeling like there was something just about to explode. A local hip-hop identity which was just sort of developing. And I do think that one of the pioneers would have been King Kapisi, who we really enjoyed.
Definitely. I mean, I think, you know, Scribe would not have been such a big hit if it hadn't have been for people like Shafu and King Kapisi and DLT, who sort of first, you know.
This is a funny thing, isn't it? We had Scribe 2001 on the playlist in 2001, and I think it came out on the album in about 2004 or something. An interesting thing about Perception is this. Around about 2002, people were assuming that the person who was pushing to get Missy Elliott on the playlist was you, and the person who was pushing to get Queens of the Stone Age on the playlist was me. It was, in fact, the other way around. I didn't really like Queens of the Stone Age, but for some reason I believed that commercial hip-hop, that was where all the risks were being taken and the ground was being broken. So I wanted things like Missy and Busta Rhymes and everything on the radio at that time, and you wanted the Queens of the Stone Age on
Yeah, because it was stoner rock.
There was problems in doing that job that we both experienced, and one of them, I think, and I'm sure it's the same all the time, but one of the problems was a kind of higher immoral ground being pushed by certain people. There was, there was a lot of dance scenes exploding, a lot of different dance scenes exploding, and a lot of drugs happening with that, and I don't drink alcohol at all or take drugs, and I just think that it doesn't lead to anywhere good, and it always disappoints me when I see it leading somewhere bad. And that quite often happened up here, seeing alcohol and drugs lead to somewhere really bad. I was really glad that they were passionate about all this stuff, but they became evangelists and decided that we were the enemy for not purely playlisting what represented their scene. I actually think during that time we managed to balance things quite well. But, you know, some people thought we should only play house music. Some people thought we only did play house music and reggae.
That's right. And it seemed like house music was taking over the entire world. Every bar you walked past was house music was blaring out of it. Every radio you turned on. And I agree. BFM still played a lot of very good house music at that period, but it didn't become entirely swamped by house music.
A lot of those people that I'm talking about were, you know, they would say they would hear something they disliked and decided that was all BFM were playing. They were going, you guys only play stoner rock. You guys only play hip hop. You guys only play Salmonella dub type music. And none of that was true. And of course, some things got lost in that. And a band that I got particularly excited about, and as did you, because I remember the day we got the first single, John Tate, who had previously done the This Is Not America show, had come back for a visit. And the previous week, he'd just got the new single from this brand new band called The Libertines. And that was amazing. We put it on straight away. We put the B-side on, and it was fantastic. And I thought the Libertines were great. And we kept on putting them on playlist. And for some reason, people kept on not playing the Libertines off the playlist and would play, you know, Basement Jack remixes of whatever. But nonetheless, I thought the Libertines were fantastic. This one is from their second album. This is When the Band Fell Apart. I think that the writing team of Pete Doherty and Carl Barat is the equal of Morrissey Marr, Strummer Jones, Jagger and Richards. We'll be right back.
start you twisting tall. I love apart your light fingers through the dark. Shatter the lamp into darkness, it cast the sun. No, you've got it the wrong way round. Just shut me up, blamed it on the ground. Call it the boy kicked out of the world. The world kicked back, and I fucking hard at all. If you wanna try, if you wanna try, there's no worse you could do.
Around that time when we were both programming, which would have been, I guess, between about 2001 and 2004, right? Around about that time?
Yes. Yep.
So during that time, and it, you know, we could look back on it and think, oh, weren't we so lucky? There was so much great music. There was all this stuff happening, like the sort of resurgence of dancehall and grime was just starting up and all of this. But the fact is, there's always interesting stuff going on. Even in the most boring times of music, there's always something interesting. You know, in the same way that when New Zealand was a horrible, oppressive, boring place in the late 70s and early 80s, there was things happening, and those things were reflected on BFM. And I think even since we stopped programming, possibly even especially since we stopped programming, there's been so much interesting music coming through. And to me, it's always really, the most exciting thing for me is thinking, this could be the one, and listen to something, this could be it, you know. And if it's only it for 2 weeks, it doesn't bother me. It's like, you know, it's that thrill of hearing something new and different and not what is being spoon-fed you from, you know, the establishment. I'm sure there is still an establishment. Luckily, they don't know about me, but...
I just want to say, I guess we're both lucky because we continue to have weekly radio shows, and even though neither of us are any longer responsible for programming songs on BFM's playlist, we both get an opportunity to play new stuff that we hear that really excites us every week.
And it is a real privilege to be allowed to do a two-hour radio show every week. I mean, you've done one for longer than me, or a regular one for longer than me. Every week, it's just exciting and a privilege. And it's not because you want to go on and go, I am the great Troy, or I am the great Dubhead. It's nothing to do with that at all. It's the fact is, I've got these records, and I hope someone gets a kick out of this. There'll be somebody out there who will listen and go, that's what I've been looking for. And that's really what it's all about. I think it is. Is it?
No, I think it is. I totally do. I love the random aspect of it, in that one week I could play something that I haven't played for 12 or 15 years, and then I'll play that tune and someone will hear it for the first time ever, and oh my god, it's a track by Culture or the Mighty Diamonds or something, and they're like, oh, it's the best thing they've ever heard. Or I might play a record that came out this week only, and no one's heard it before, but they hear it and they're like, wow, that's fantastic. That's the best tune I've ever heard.
And if you're still doing your show in 15 years, the chances are you'll play that song again and there'll be somebody else discovering it going, whoa, listen to that classic from 2009. Oh, my God, that's awesome. You know, that's what I think a radio station is. I don't think that it's about, well, I could be wrong. I always figure that a radio station is about playing music that you get a kick out of, that you want someone else to get a kick out of. It's as simple as that, you know. And that's why that it's, you know, I've always avoided becoming stereotyped into one kind of music, because if you get stereotyped into it, you get stuck there. And imagine getting stuck there and not being able to listen to new things anymore. That would be awful. Exciting things have continued to happen.
Oh, you didn't mention your stint for a while doing Totally Wired as well as the Rock and Roll Wire. And that was the new music show. And I kind of, again, just more opportunity for you to be listening to new stuff that no one had ever heard before and demos. And
for a time in the first part of this century, when was that? I guess it was, well, maybe it was from 1999 to about 2002 or something like that, or maybe 2003. I did the Totally Wired show, not solely by myself. I'd alternate week by week with Ben Hill at first and then Pat Fife after that. But the CD as format wasn't dead, as we're told these days. And so there'd be this gigantic box full of stuff, and it'd be like all the stuff you'd never heard of. And it was this these ridiculous obscure house CDs and you know, stuff from the major labels that you would have thought, oh, this is probably crap. Oh, no, I better listen to it. And sure enough, there'd be something great. And that was a really exciting show to do, because just the breadth of things that were being sent to BFM was just like real fun. Is that a vacuum cleaner I hear? I thought you said Andrew Black was in hospital. Andrew, put that... BFM started in 1969, and I'm pretty sure it was started by people who had a passion for doing something different and for reflecting what was going on that was not, you know, evident everywhere you look in Auckland or in New Zealand. And I think that's still the same. I've always felt pretty much the same about BFM since I first heard it in 1979 or 1980. I still feel the same when I turn it on, thinking, I hope I hear something that's going to make me go, yes, or whatever. The last song we're going to play is something which came out last year. It was a duo from Canada that got a lot of bad press, and I don't care about bad press. I like bands who have bad press. And they were accused of ripping off the 8-bit scene.
We weren't trying to rip off the 8-bit scene, we were trying to rip off the glitch scene.
This duo is called Crystal Castles, and this is probably their signature song. It's called Alice Practice, and the reason it's called Alice Practice was, well, Alice, the singer, was practicing on...
You have been listening to the BFM Historical Society, a documentary series made to commemorate BFM's 40th anniversary. The Historical Society is broadcast at 11 a.m. every Saturday morning and is available as a podcast from BFM's website later on in the week. The Historical Society is produced at BFM by Dubhead.